So as all the other speakers have said, it's a pleasure to be here. I thank the organizers for the opportunity. It's an amazingly nice time to come visit Santa Barbara, and it's even in spite of that, been a very fruitful and rewarding workshop, which is a high standard to meet when there are other distractions. What I want to do is I want to talk about open issues in 115 materials, and what I want to try to do is show you that some of the issues that Catherine raised a couple days ago are actually manifest in the 115 materials, and use that sort of as a mechanism and as an excuse to highlight some recent results and point to recent issues. And so what I want to try to do is frame different aspects as in sort of the form of a question or discussion. And so I'm necessarily glossing over lots of details, and I'd be happy to provide you as much details or not as you want in doing that. And so there's four basic things I want to talk about. One is that it would seem that in these 115 materials, we actually, at least after the fact, have some ability to tune TC, and there are a couple things that one can at least parameterize TC with, and so one can ask the question, what are we actually changing here, and does one understand that? Then I want to talk about some recent work on tindopine and serum cobalt indium-5, and this is one of the cases that Catherine alluded to that seems to be something different in serum cobalt indium-5. Because there appears to be something that looks like a field-induced quantum critical point near HC2. And these results show how that evolves as a function of doping. Talk about multiple superconducting states that may or may not exist in cerium, rhodium, iridium, indium-5, and relate that to some work that's been done recently in cerium copper-2-silicon-2 and cerium copper-2-germanium-2. And then point to some issues around Fermi surface and two-fluid models, which is really a setup for some things that Nick Curl will talk about later in the afternoon. So the first thing I want to talk about is the extent to which we can tune TC and we seem to understand things. I think there's an important thing to remember here, which is sort of, it's not really a specific statement, but it does seem to be the case that for heavy fermions especially, there are certain crystal structures that like to superconduct. And this the 1-2-2 structure that cerium copper-2-silicon-2 crystallizes in is one of those structures. And this 115 structure seems to be so also. And it's sort of a philosophical question why that's the case. And if we could actually understand why those structures like to superconduct, we'd be pretty far ahead in finding new and different examples of superconductors. So given the extent to which people have gotten beaten up for disorder issues and sample quality and stuff, I want to sort of over-elaborate this a little bit and talk about samples up front and tell you what we're doing. So the starting point for the whole 115 sort of discussion is this material cerium indium-3 that's been around for quite some time and is a pretty clear example of an antiferromagnet giving way to a superconductor at what appears to be a quantum critical point, at least in the loose sense of the word, because there is some discussion here about whether this is actually a first order transition or a second order transition. So I don't want to get into that other than to say it's clearly an example of a magnet going to a superconductor. You see non-Fermi liquid behavior in the vicinity of where magnetism goes away, and you observe superconductivity. And there's reasonable evidence that this is a D-wave superconductor, as evidenced, for example, by T1 measurements as a function of pressure by Kitaoka's group in Japan. So this is sort of the prototype. And arguably, what one has in the 115 materials is a layered version of this. So this is the crystal structure of cerium indium-3. And at least crudely, what you can do is you can insert a metal layer here, get this 115 structure, and if you really force the analogy, then you can argue that this cerium indium-3 layer is like the copper oxide layer in the cuprates. There's this metal layer that tends to separate things, and so what you have is a two-dimensional version of cerium indium-3. Stated that way, that's almost certainly overstated, because, for example, these materials aren't that anisotropic. They're all pretty good metals. But there's a fairly large family of these, and what I want to mostly talk about is how you manipulate the properties by changing various things. And in fact, there are examples where you can change all the different sites here and see what happens. So the first example I'll talk about is you can replace cerium, which is a 4F electron, with plutonium, which has 5F electrons. And in fact, you can do pretty dramatic things. You can increase TC by almost a factor of 10. So you get almost an 18.5 Kelvin superconductor in plutonium cobalt gallium-5. We'll also talk about the extent to which, although these are not layered compounds in any real sense of the word, the extent, the amount of tetragonalness, the ratio of this C lattice constant to this A lattice constant, there's a pretty profound effect in how you change C relative to A and how that tunes TC, and we'll talk about that. I will also talk about what you do on the metal site. So you can, on this metal site, the compounds are interesting from the point of view of magnetism and superconductivity for when the metal is rhodium, iridium, or cobalt, and you can make various intermediate alloys between them. Everything I'll talk about is single crystals, and I don't think there's really any particular issues about disorder or homogeneity unless you raise that particularly. One thing worth noting is that rhodium, iridium, and cobalt all are on the same column. So what you're changing here is actually a more subtle thing than just changing hole count or something like that. So there's something being tuned when you substitute rhodium for iridium and cobalt in this layer, which isn't directly coupled to superconductivity. So that's why I think disorder doesn't matter so much, but interesting things happen. And then we'll also finally talk about what happens when you substitute tin on this indium site, and I'll motivate why we did that, which was actually not, in the end, the reason we did it was not a good reason, but the results are still interesting. I won't talk about it all, but I'll point out that they exist. There's a bilayer version of the same structure. And so if you take this crystal structure and take one unit of cerium indium 3, stack another one on top before you do the metal layer, you actually get 218. And there's a whole family of cerium and plutonium 218 compounds that also happen to be magnets and superconductors. They're just relatively less well studied than the 115 case. So the first thing I'll show you is something that Nick will probably talk about more later, and that's some fairly recent NMR measurements on plutonium, cobalt, gallium 5. So what I'm showing you here is 1 over T1 as a function of temperature, and what one sees in plutonium, cobalt, gallium 5 is pretty good evidence for D-wave superconductivity. So you see a TQ power law in T1. It's consistent with what you see in heat capacity at low temperatures. So this says it's a D-wave superconductor. What's more interesting from the point I want to make is if you look at the normal state properties, you can plot 1 over T1 as a function of reduced temperature, and if you normalize the data relative to a particular spin fluctuation temperature, you can get data, for example, for cerium, cobalt, indium 5, plutonium, cobalt, gallium 5, and YBCO all to collapse on the same basic form. So there's something common about all these materials, and arguably, at least in a general sense, that has something to do with quantum critical behavior and spin fluctuation mediated superconductivity. And so if you do that, the sort of the interesting plot you can make is there are these various plots people have made of supernatant transition temperature versus some characteristic spin fluctuation temperature. And there's always been this sort of cluster of cuprate-like materials up high and heavy fermion materials down low, and there's this gap. And so the argument you can make, for whatever it's worth, is somehow plutonium, cobalt, gallium 5 is solidly in the middle. And so there's some evolution between 4F-based superconductors, 3D-based superconductors, and this 5F case is somewhere in the middle. And it would certainly be nice to populate this region in greater detail. So you can, for example, by looking at, so some of these things you can look at values of gamma, C over T, and infer a TSF. You can also pick it off from the T1 data. You can get it from resistivity and the cuprates. So I think the numbers one is using are pretty conventional, so I don't want to dwell on the details. But that's, for example, yeah, and you can do similar things here and stuff. So, I mean, the full details of that are rather complicated, and I think if one is really trying to assert some particular form, one would need to do that. But it's any reasonable choice, things fall in a line. So the thing that's worth discussing in a little more detail is the following. In addition to all these stoichiometric 115 materials tending to be superconductors, for example, cerium, cobalt, indium 5, which is this 2 Kelvin superconductor, and cerium iridium indium 5, which is this 0.4 Kelvin superconductor, you can make various intermediate alloys. And you can grow these as single crystals, and you can measure their TCs. And you can also measure how tetragonal they are, the ratio of this C lattice constant to the A lattice constant. And if you do that in the case of cerium, you find this rather curious result, that you see pretty solid linear behavior between TC and C over A. That TC goes up when things become more tetragonal, isn't so surprising, because the simple expectation is more anisotropic is good for spin fluctuations, and therefore TC goes up. The surprising thing is C over A is not changing very much. So you're only making a couple percent changes in C over A, and you're making factor of five changes in TC. So whatever you're actually changing here, and C over A must be some measure of something, there's a pretty strong effect on what TC is doing. And so that says you're tuning something that's good for superconductivity. So that's interesting enough in the case of in the cerium case. What's even more surprising is when you look at the plutonium case, again, the stoichiometric end members are plutonium cobalt gallium 5, which has a TC over 18, and plutonium rhodium gallium 5, whose TC is about 8. And again, if you make intermediate alloys, you again find a linear relationship. Now, of course, the scales are changed because TC, sort of the baseline TC, is higher here than in the cerium case. And in fact, the baseline value of C over A is different here than here. But in fact, the slope of this line is the same. So there's some universal slope that says that sort of the logarithmic derivative of TC relative to C over A is both steep and the same, both for the cerium case and the plutonium case.
So you use gallium to generate the proper C to A ratio for the actinides.
You use gallium because gallium, if you try to make plutonium M indium 5, it doesn't make, presumably because the indium is just too big. So using something smaller like gallium makes more room.
What do you mean the slope is the same?
Right, but the slope of this line using this scale and this scale is the same number as the slope using this one and this one. So y is different and x is different, but dy dx is the same number. You can replot the data for yourself and convince yourself of that. But in fact, the slope is the same. And so somehow you can normalize out those relative scales, and that's what's sort of curious. And so, especially, I mean, it's one thing to say, well, let's start from the high end TCs and say, well, if I alloy these things, TC goes down, and so I can understand that. But if you sort of think about it from the opposite direction and say, here's a perfectly good stoichiometric superconductor, I'm going to alloy that and disorder it and make mess of it, and what do you find? You find the TC goes zooming up. And so certainly there is disorder because you're making alloys, but you're certainly doing something much more powerful, like optimizing anisotropy or something to make TC go up. And other than the Cooper rates, there really aren't many other examples that do this kind of thing. Right. So that's a good segue to the next slide. So these materials aren't very anisotropic in bulk, and depending on what your definition is, you measure anisotropies of 2 or 3 or 5 or 7. What you do find, though, is when you do electronic structure calculations in both the cerium case and the plutonium case, and when you measure Fermi surfaces, at least in the cerium case, you find a Fermi surface has got a couple pieces. So there's a fairly spherical piece that's fairly boring and presumably shorts out whatever real anisotropy there is. But there's this quasi-cylindrical piece that's universal in all these things. And you can measure how cylindrical or warped the cylinder is by the differences between these alpha orbits. This difference between, say, alpha 1 and alpha 2 and alpha 3 is measurably smaller. It's more cylindrical, say, in cerium cobalt indium 5 than in cerium rhodium indium 5 or cerium rhodium indium 5. So that's the strongest direct correlation, is that this piece of Fermi surface, which is quasi two-dimensional, is more cylindrical as TC goes up.
I was actually asking after the crystal,
if you
use single ion
magnetic anisotropy, does that change at all? So it does. It's a little, I think the literature is a little controversial on that. So it looks like there are changes in that. There are multiple evolutions that you can fit the data to. And so there are scenarios that say that the B4, the particular crystal field splitting, strongly correlates to TC. I think neutrons prove that not to be the case. But it's more this itinerant character thing that's more correlatable to TC than anything else. So I want to leave that now and then turn to something else. And so if there's other questions on that topic, I'd be happy to address them. So the other thing I want to talk about is something that Catherine alluded to, and that's what happens in cerium cobalt indium 5 as a function of field. So this is a temperature magnetic field phase diagram for cerium cobalt indium 5. when you apply fields along the c-axis, HC2 is about 5 tesla. And what you see is that at increasingly higher fields, you see a non-Fermi liquid regime that becomes Fermi liquid-like. And so in some sense, in some simple sense, that's like ytterbium-rhodium-2-silicon-2. And if you do these kinds of Maria fits and sort of extract where the critical point is, what you find is that the critical point is rather close to HC2. And so how can that happen? So the simple argument is the following. It turns out that if you go back to cerium cobalt indium 5, cerium cobalt indium 5 in this temperature pressure plot happens to be here, and the same data plotted differently happened to be here. And what you see in cerium cobalt indium 5 when you apply pressure to it is that TC goes over a maximum, so there's this sort of well-defined dome of superconductivity. There's this region of non-Fermi liquid behavior, and if you sort of adopt coup rate vocabulary, as you go over doped, you recover Fermi liquid behavior. So what this is presumably suggesting is there's some anti-ferromagnet just back here at slightly negative pressure, for example. And so if there was some anti-ferromagnet just back here at slightly negative pressure, that would presumably be the thing that's giving rise to this critical point here that you can't quite reach. And so you get superconductivity out of the way, and there's some kind of quantum critical point here. So that's not totally crazy, because one of the things you can do, because I've sort of shown you that it doesn't really matter what you do on the metal site. You can put rhodium there or cobalt there, and both in terms of tuning the C over A business, and also, as I'll show you here, as a function of pressure, cerium rhodium indium 5 and cerium cobalt indium 5 look a lot like each other. So if you just make a chemical pressure shift, which accounts just for what the A-axis lattice constant does, so it ignores this anisotropy effect, you can collapse the pressure-dependent data for cerium rhodium indium 5, which are these data here and these data here. So cerium rhodium indium 5 at ambient pressure is a magnet. When you apply pressure, it becomes a superconductor whose TC is about 2 Kelvin. Those data can be made to fall basically on top of the data for cerium cobalt indium 5 and just its TC evolution as a function of pressure. So it's not totally crazy to imagine that there's this anti-ferromagnet just back here at slightly negative pressure. And in some sense, it's just cerium rhodium indium 5. And so cerium rhodium indium 5 and cerium cobalt indium 5 are basically just the same compound. So then the question becomes, is there some way you can, since physically applying negative pressure is kind of tricky, is there a way chemically you can apply negative pressure? Is there some substitution you can do to apply negative pressure to cerium cobalt indium 5, magically recover this magnet, and have this whole story hold together? So the answer turns out to be no, but it's actually more interesting in some sense. And that's what I'll describe for you here. So these are the data for cerium cobalt indium 5 that I showed you, which again have the superconductivity ending at HC2 and giving rise to this critical point where non-Fermi liquid behavior crosses over to Fermi liquid behavior.
Can I ask a question about that?
So, yeah.
I mean, so if you come down in field in that Fermi liquid,
right,
and just look at the low temperature resistance, you get a lot of precursor superconducting fluctuations, or is it just...
Maybe there's data on the previous slide. No, that's heat capacity. You get a little bit of that, but it's pretty straightforward to tell where you're getting sort of precursor superconductivity and not. And the range isn't particularly large. One of the things that I didn't tell you, in fact, is at fields at about this high, the superconducting transition actually goes from being second order to first order, and there's some evidence for FFLO superconductivity here, which is a perfectly interesting separate topic. It's sort of a complication from this point of view, but I think it's pretty easy to map out where you are, and it's not anomalous in any particular sense. So you have the superconducting region. The idea is you substitute tin for indium. Naively, you could convince yourself that would apply negative pressure. It turns out
they're just
neighbors, and so it's not. Because chemical substitution can do other bad things like disorder. You can do gallium. The thing we've tried most is tin, and tin seems to work well. The thing with tin is, it turns out, if I can find it. Apologies for this. It turns out that in principle, because tin and indium are pretty much the same thing, you might naively expect tin would just go over both indium sites and be homogeneous. It turns out that the tin preferentially goes for this indium site. And so for people who've thought about cerium-indium-3 and cerium-tin-3, what you're probably actually doing is making this layer much more cerium-tin-3-like than cerium-indium-3-like. And how you go from cerium-indium-3 to cerium-tin-3 is actually a much more complicated issue than just applying pressure. So our little idea about negative pressure was just a bad idea, and what we're really doing is more complicated. But for this discussion, that doesn't matter. Because what one finds is that, of course, when you substitute tin for indium, especially if it's preferentially going on the cerium-indium-3 layer, that should do bad things for superconductivity. So that should drive TC down, for example. And in fact, TC goes away, although it's not plotted here. TC goes away at a pretty reasonably fast clip. And for example, the rate at which TC is suppressed here with tin substitution is actually faster than the rate it's suppressed, say, with lanthanum substitution.
Right. You put the tin in also, probably you're trying to somehow control the amount of tin that goes in.
Right.
But in reality, a priori, you have no idea how much goes in.
That's correct.
Now, A, that's a problem, so how do you determine how much goes in?
Right.
B, how do you know the same amount's going in from the center of the sample to the outside? Because I've done substitutions like this
right.
out in the system,
right.
but that can be a great answer.
Absolutely. So you're exactly right. A priori, you know nothing. If you put it in, it turns out by doing things like microprobe measurements, both in a given batch and across a given crystal to check for homogeneity regions, as well as measuring it directly, say with X-ray absorption near its spectroscopy, you get about 60% of the tin that you think goes in, and about 60% of it goes on this indium-1 site. And so you just have to measure it directly.
And across how big a crystal? You have to go through, break it in half, and do a line across.
Yeah.
What's the variation?
Very small. So certainly much less than 10% of the quoted value. So there seems to be none, but I'm just not going to say there is no variation because there seems to be no systematic, and it seems to be very well controlled. And given that you know sort of the net yield you get, if you go make batch after batch, the properties are perfectly reproducible. So it seems to work perfectly nicely, much better than you expect. So still the point here is the following. So superconductivity goes away. What you're doing here, what you'd hope is that superconductivity would get out of the way, this critical point would stay here, and you could study this critical point just like you study it in a terbium rhodium 2 silicon 2 or doped versions of the same. Catherine?
On the right, the blue on the ring, it's measured from resistivity?
So TFLC means measured by heat capacity, and TFL rho means measured by resistivity. So it's probably T crossover. So probably there's some region in some concentrations where it's not obvious where you're at because it's going one or the other.
Basically, what you mean, the resistivity has some
strength crossover. Yeah. So for example, for precursor superconductivity reasons, it hasn't really gotten all the way to T squared, say.
Yes.
So in pure cerium cobalt indium 5, it's like 2 decades in temperature, and there's not any noticeable.
No.
At highest fields when it crosses over here, yes, but not in the same way. It's also not been mapped out as carefully as in the pure stuff. Naively expect is that this point wouldn't move, because if this critical point were separate from superconductivity, this would just get stuck here, and you could do a perfectly good job of answering Catherine's questions about what's really happening here. And that doesn't happen. What happens is this critical point seems to track HC2 perfectly well. And so you can, for example, do these kinds of scaling plots, and if you look at any of the 0 or the 3% or the 6%, the data can all be scaled in the same way, and so what you basically conclude is that the critical point is HC2. So that leads to two sort of equally implausible explanations. One is that it's just a superconducting critical point. So the critical point is HC2, and as it moves, you get that critical point right there. Most of the theories that I know say that superconductivity isn't critical enough to give rise to this region of fluctuations, especially because of the issue that here you have a first-order superconducting transition. Certainly out here you've lost that and you have a second-order transition. It just shouldn't stick to superconductivity. But so you may not buy that scenario, but the other scenario is equally problematic, because that basically says, well, there's still some anti-ferromagnetic critical point somewhere. We still keep missing it, and somehow everything scales so perfectly that TC goes away and this scales away, and this point is just magically fixed to some fluctuation spectrum that you're tuning, that's conventional and magnetic, that you're tuning as a function of doping. So we don't know, and it's kind of curious that it evolves this way.
So John, sorry, maybe
Is there a specific prediction, Piers?
Well, I mean, there's all of these quantum critical points you can look at, and there are phenomena examples of localization, but nothing dramatic. Nothing like that at all. It's very hard to get a very strong scattering effect from air fluctuation. But that's a BCS theory, it's all there. Because you could have imagined other weird types of
So I was noticing that same thing. There are certainly more data points, and this is just a bad pick of the data. So there certainly are more. That certainly is not sufficient, and I'm glad somebody's actually paying attention. So I'm going to move along. So I mean, whatever's going on, something is evolving here. It's an interesting question: what is evolving, and how one maps that out. At higher concentrations, you do see disorder effects, where you start to see changes in these power laws, for example. But that you see it here says here things are pretty clean. So now let me move along. The other thing I want to talk about is cerium rhodium indium 5 and cerium rhodium indium 5. And so,
what was the second scenario?
So either there's some anti-ferromagnetic critical point of some sort whose fluctuation spectrum gives rise both to superconductivity and to the critical point, and 10 substitutions causes that to change in exactly the same way. So HC2 always accidentally coincides with the critical field. I mean, all that's crazy. That would be consistent.
John, does the right endpoint, so the endpoint of the crossover region at higher field, move with doping, or does it stay more or less the same? You can just go back one slide. I mean, it almost looks to be more or less independent, right? I mean, if we cross the dash line. I mean, there's this crossover region and the right endpoint, right?
Right.
Of the crossover region.
Right, so in here you mean.
Exactly, that does not seem to move too much with the door, right?
Certainly as drawn, you're right. I don't. I mean, since what we've been most interested in is this point into which it moves, I don't know the data robust enough to make strong statements about that, and my guess is that they're not.
And it's also true as a function of turning the field around, right? If you turn the field.
Certainly that's true in pure serum cobalt indium 5. I'm not aware of data in the other direction for all these dopings. That's what we're working on at the moment. All right. So the other thing to talk about is you can look at cerium rhodium indium 5 to cerium iridium indium 5. And there's lots of things one could talk about how magnetism gives rise to superconductivity and issues of coexistence. That's not what I want to emphasize here. What I want to emphasize here is there's this very little window here at about 90% iridium and 10% rhodium, which since sort of the very beginning of looking at these things, there's been this region where TC goes away. And you've got to be pretty ambitious to argue there's something going on here, because in dope samples that TC starts going down, I'd be pretty hard to convince you there's anything there. But what I want to convince you is there's something there, and I want to do that for the following reason. If you take now a set of samples in this rhodium-iridium slice of things at various concentrations and now apply pressure to various of those concentrations, what you see is that this little window here actually opens up to a fairly wider region of non-superconductivity. So what was just sort of a little defect has become a well-developed region where you seem to have characteristic TC on the order of 2 Kelvin over here. And so this is presumably the well-behaved spin fluctuation cerium cobalt indium 5-like superconductor whose pressure thing all collapses. And on the iridium side, there's something different. So there, this TC never gets above 1 Kelvin in cerium iridium indium 5, even under very high pressures, much higher than this. And there's a well-defined region where you go from superconductor to nothing to superconductor. So what's going on here? We certainly don't have as much data as, for example, some of these very nice studies people have done on cerium copper 2 silicon 2 doped with germanium. But here the argument is there's actually a crossover from spin fluctuation superconductivity to charge fluctuation superconductivity. And the claim is maybe there's something similar going on here. And the interesting novelty is, in this case, in both cases, there's a characteristic TC of 1 Kelvin and a characteristic TC of 2 Kelvin. Naively, here you'd say the spin one is 2 Kelvin and the charge one is 1 Kelvin, and it's backwards there. So whether there's any a priori reason of the relative order of these TCs isn't clear. But this is worth study. And certainly here you'd be hard-pressed to believe something going on. There's definitely something going on here. So John is flipping through slides, so I'll try to wrap this up. So I'm just going to show one thing. So Catherine showed this on Tuesday, which was this very nice DHV as a function of pressure data by Onuki's group on cerium rhodium 2 silicon 2, where clearly the effective mass peaks up at some critical pressure and starts coming down. And I just want to point out, and this is work that I have nothing at all to do with other than having to know about it, that Onuki's group is doing exactly the same thing in the 115s. So in cerium rhodium indium 5, they actually see M star go up rather dramatically near the critical pressures where it becomes superconducting. They actually have more data that also shows some shifts in frequencies, which I couldn't find when I was trying to find a slide. They also see in cerium cobalt indium 5 that the effective mass goes down as a function of pressure. And so if you buy my argument that cerium rhodium indium 5 and cerium cobalt indium 5 are somehow related and you can scale them to each other, this actually holds together pretty nicely because you actually see a pretty strong upturn in the effective mass going over and coming back down once you go past a critical point. And if you use my pressure scaling from before, you'd make that match at about 1.6 GPA. So this would be about the same as that. So the same thing seems to be happening here, as is also the case in cerium rhodium 2 silicon 2 and other things. So with that, I will stop. And thank you for your attention and be happy to answer any other questions you might have. So the magnet, that's a good question. Unfortunately, you need 60 or 70 Tesla to get up there. So the magnet is very robust, and so to oh, as a function of temperature, you mean? So it's not quite clear. So Dirk showed us data on Tuesday that said that from optics measurements, the effective mass isn't as big in cerium rhodium indium 5 as in the other cases. What that probably says is that cerium rhodium indium 5 is not as heavy as people think it is. So there's a fairly large region of just spin fluctuations that make C over T look bigger, that make the resistivity not be strictly T or strictly T squared. But I think it's just magnetic fluctuations close to an anti-ferromagnet. And that's why the optics data show it not to be as heavy. There's also work by Greg Stewart and Highfield that show the same thing. So in cerium cobalt indium 5, you have rock solid T linear resistivity for 2 decades and temperature above TC. The studies of sort of alloys between the antiferromagnet and the superconductor, there's nothing really intelligent to say about them. I mean, they're not highly disordered, so rho naught doesn't go through the roof or anything, but there's not any obvious behavior where you can say, oh, this is characteristically Fermi liquid or not, as a function of alloying in that way.
Okay, let's move to the other side. Chandra, I have something probably related to some of the earlier experiments which touch on this question of sort of avoided anti-ferromagnetism.
Right.
It has to do with the measurements when you measure the entropy as a function of temperature.
Right.
COP, and then sort of can I do a sketch?
Yes.
I think very interesting phenomena that if you look at C over T and you see something like that
was the temperature, and now you have a superconducting transition, and you're seeing something, I'm not exaggerating, really large, and you see something like this, and if you were to just extrapolate this, this area is about three times
right. This
area.
Okay. Right.
So, of course, the measurement is correct, because if you apply a magnetic field to suppress superconductivity, this thing begins to do this.
Right.
Okay, so, and now, if you extrapolate this, and at low temperature, it doesn't matter whether it's going to log or going to a constant. Then you get nearly...
Right, and so to be specific, that's the case of cerium, cobalt, indium 5.
So what seems to be happening is that the sum of the entropy which would have appeared sort of fermionic is appearing in your in the jump in the superconductivity, your effective...
Right.
In other words, your effective gap over TC, etc.
Right.
Has been fantastically enhanced.
Right.
And this seems to be something that in a completely different context happens in compounds where you have S-wave superconductivity, competition of S-wave superconductivity and charge density wave, like niobium diselenide,
right.
In the sense that if you apply pressure, TC goes up, charge density wave transition temperature comes up, and then you completely avoid the charge density wave transition.
Right.
It doesn't
right.
That is, so here also it seems like I may be mistaken, but I do not know of any example where you have anti-ferromagnetism being seen, transition arising below the superconducting transition temperature of a D-wave type, or a charge density wave transition arising below an S-wave superconductivity. They seem to
spell
each other. And in fact, this is more dramatically seen in one of these compounds, I forget what, erbium, etc., in which you see a soft mode coming down in phonon, and this is at some commensurate vector, and I think it's relevant.
Right.
So this is now coming down as a function of temperature, and now you would expect, gee, something's gone. But now suddenly there is superconductivity happening at this temperature, and the moment superconductivity happens, so let's say this thing was some number, 20 MeV. Sorry?
It's the TC and the carbon.
That's right.
Right.
So this is neuton scattering by Shirane, Chassis, and the Japanese.
Yes.
Right.
So now, so you used to see this phonon. And it was coming down. And now suddenly there's a superconducting transition, and this now phonon suddenly becomes a structure like this. And this thing appears around 2 delta. You see it in phonon scattering, with the total integrated area conserved.
Right.
Okay, so what I'm trying to say is that there always seems to be, if you have commensurate structural transitions, there always seems to be arresting of the transition by superconductivity, and it appears that when you have something antiferromagnetic about to happen, if it's at a commensurate wave vector, superconductivity arrests it. My guess is that if spin fluctuation spectrum is studied by neutron scattering, something like that will be seen at 2 kF below the superconducting transition as well.
Right. So the part of Patrick's question that I was not answering was so that's certainly true. There's also a well-behaved anti-ferromagnet. How the anti-ferromagnet goes to the superconductor isn't clear as a function of doping. It is the case in cerium-2, rhodium-indium-8 that there's some chance that the magnetism does coexist after TC comes first, but that's still work in progress.
Okay, maybe a last question.
No, you made a point about
Yeah. So in fact, you can do that, and if you just infer what the uniaxial pressure derivative is from thermal expansion, which Philip has done, you get that same slope.
Okay.
And you can apply small uniaxial pressures, and to the extent that you get enough data to see them, that's the same slope. That's not a very rigorous test, because you just can't go very far in effective uniaxialness. But yes, that's a good test, and it does pass that test.
Okay, really last
question. Just one comment, one sentence. It's actually interesting that these anti-terminal systems, they have very superconductors, they have very different impurities. Sometimes it's suppressed very quickly, and sometimes, as in your case, it stays. And I don't think there's a general understanding why this is so different.
Right.
The question I have is a quick one. Do we see any of this upturn that was observed in turbine rolling through silicon tube, either as a function of pressure or temperature, equilibrium temperatures in specific heat or low fields in these?
So I'm not aware of any specific evidence. Part of the problem is the indium nuclear Schottky. I mean, since you're subtracting that out, you easily could miss some small contribution just by your attempts to subtract that. But with that caveat, no, I'm not aware of any. On the doping thing, I think it's overly naive to make it this simple, but the fact that you're doping out of the plane is a good thing for 115. And so certainly when you do things like tin substitution, it's much worse for TC than rhodium, iridium, and cobalt substitutions, which are out of the way. But that is too simplistic of a view. But it's not completely wrong, I think.
Okay, great. Thank you. Let's start John again.